Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the No Low Ballers podcast. I'm your host, Logan Medish of High Caliber History. Joined around the table, we have Alan from Gunbroker, Dan from Go Wild, and our guest today, Eric Gelhaus. Eric, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
I appreciate you having me. Glad to be here.
So we're going to get to red dots, and that's what we're going to talk about. But to get to that point, we'll reference for those of you who've been keeping up on the show and watching the show for a while. There was an older episode where I brought in a piece of my collection, and it was a very early reflex sight that was designed to be mounted on a shotgun, and it had come out of the technology of World War II bomb sights.
Okay.
That was adapted into a shotgunning sight. And that is kind of how we're looking at it, as like the great granddaddy of what we have with red dots.
And it weighed as much as the bomb sight, or the plane the bomb sight was attached to.
That thing weighed a ton. You had this sight and the Enola Gay, and they weighed the exact same, you know? Yeah. Like, it was ridiculous. We get into, obviously, that thing wasn't a true red dot, you know, but it is the precursor. You know, you can kind of see where things are going with that. So talk to us about the infancy of the red dot and the birth and the progression.
So I guess you guys have probably talked about the competition side of it before.
We really haven't.
No.
We really haven't, so.
Okay, so what I found going back to like the 80s, people were first starting to put some of the early red dot optics on competition pistols for the open stuff in IPSC, UPSA, USPSA, where I think we can trace it back defensively is like Kelly McCann in the mid-00s, and then kind of Dave Spalding. And Dave had done a bunch of stuff with Kelly in that time frame. The first time I remember anything from Spalding was like 09, maybe 10, where Dave was putting, I can't remember the model, but one of the very early red dots on one of his Glock 19s and running the snot out of it in classes.
Well, let's stop back on the open class for a second, though, because those were, you know, like Seymour Sights, a couple other brands, but they were large. They were not small units. They were kind of heavy as well, and frankly, they were a little on the delicate side as well as the way they were mounted.
So, they weren't mounted on the slide at all. There weren't slide cuts. There weren't factory mounts for them. Guys were doing at that time, everyone that I was seeing in competition was some sort of frame mount.
And this predates Picatinny rails on the frame, too.
Long before. So these were like either bolted into the side of the frame. Mm-hmm. On some of the 1911 style guns, I can remember they would replace the left side grip panel. That would come up to a mount that would sit up over the slide. Mm-hmm. And that would they would attach the optics. And we're talking things like Tasco Pro Points. You mentioned the Seymour sight, things along those lines, right? Fast forward to the OOs with Kelly, and I wish I could remember the optic. I can't. But that was when they were first machining slides and cutting them and finding a way to bolt stuff down in.
I want to say, was it the Doctor some of their
was that, Doctor that sounds right. The Doctor,
Doctor was some of the earliest, but since then, battery life's improved, because the other thing with those old open sights, I mean, you put a set in before the match started, and you sometimes hope to make it to the end of the match with the dot still going.
Right. My first dot, I got an Insights MRDS in 2010. The way to mount one of those, and I can't remember if it was Bushnell or Burris, but they made a plate that would go into the rear sight dovetail. Mm-hmm. So knock out your old rear sight, pound the base in, bolt the plate to it, and bolt the optic. So you would have the bore line sight line offset about like an M4 with an EOTech or an aimpoint sitting on it, right? And we've got photos of that just shows how much of the gap that was.
And certainly not holster friendly, let alone concealable holster friendly.
No, that was going to be a match gun.
Yeah. And even when they first started going on, you know, defensive guns, they were duty guns. They weren't concealed. It was you know, they were large. I mean, you usually put on a Glock 17, a full-sized M&P, a 226, not anything below that. In fact, if you even suggested it for carry, I mean, the optics just wouldn't take it.
Yeah, they wouldn't take it. So I set up late 2011. I had Dave Housel done at L&M Precision cut an M&P slide for me. Went with a Turgicon RMR for a duty gun. Figured we'd try it for a year. We ran into the first problem we ran into was holsters. So nobody made a holster that would take an optic. So EMT shears, a Dremel tool, and emery cloth to, you know, several of us were doing to Safariland 6280s, hoping the bale stayed high enough or we're cutting the holsters apart to make them work.
Scott Carnahan has PTSD to this day just thinking about it.
The first one I had on the gun ran 8 months. It was great. But when it failed mechanically. Sorry,
catastrophically.
Like the windage elevation broke, and you could just watch the dot track across. Went through several more optics over the next several months and finally kind of walked away from it because it just wasn't there. But like I was talking with guys at Turgicon today, those optics weren't designed to be on pistols in that era. That those early sights were designed to sit on an M4 or a rifle of some sort as a backup sight.
And stationary. I think that's the biggest thing. They're designed to be mounted on something that was relatively stationary. You know, the bolt in a rifle kind of moves independently, where on a slide mount, they're getting, I mean, that's a lot of recoil impulse and energy.
It's like the world's worst roller coaster for a red dot, you know.
They were finding some pretty significant G-forces on the slides. Even with the 9s, the 40, they were getting to be pretty off the hook in terms of the rating.
And wasn't there also some issues going the other way, that even that little additional weight on the slide was throwing off the physics of the firearm itself and the recycling issues? And
I didn't experience that with the M&P. I've heard about it, but I haven't experienced with the M&P. The one thing I did see on physics, Glock slides seem to break optics electronically. The M&P seem to break them mechanically. And I haven't been able to sit down with an engineer who can explain it to me, but a couple other guys saw that we had once things breaking one way and another breaking another way.
That's really weird.
I think it has to do with the physics of the recoil, how that gun recoils.
It, you know, recoil is such a weird thing. You know, we're working with Leupold. They kept having problems with air guns. The recoil impulse of an air gun was delivering a much smaller spike, obviously, but it was just in that right frequency that for this scope it was having issues. So they had to basically make a different design for air guns. And then, of course, when FN brought up the SCAR, it was known as the scope killer because that op rod, that additional weight slamming back, just destroyed everyone's optic.
Yeah.
They brought the guns to Leupold. They sat down and developed everything together so that they knew their scopes could take the SCAR, and that kind of solved it for everybody else.
Hmm. So, you know, it's interesting to me because we're talking about, you know, the optics and the guns not being friendly to the optics and the mounting systems not being there. And, you know, we think about it as, oh, my gosh, this was so long ago, right? You know, and you're like, oh, that was back in 2011. And you're like, that was only 13 years ago, you know. And you look at just how incredibly far it all has come in such a relatively short period of time. You know, Alan, you said right before we started, you know, now if you introduce a gun that is not cut for optics today, like, the thing might as well be dead in the water, you know. And 13 years is not a long time for us to have come so very far in this.
And it's interesting how we've cycled.
Yes.
So when I put, not the first one I put on a 1911, the first one I set up for duty was direct milled. Mark Housel goes in, cuts it specifically for an RMR, throw the RMR, there's no plates. Then you have the MOS system, the core system, so now everybody's running one cut, different plates, and there's more than just those two. Well, now we're seeing, especially Smith & Wesson and Glock, with the SKUs coming back to direct milled slides for either the Trigicon footprint or the Aimpoint Acro footprint. And there's one or two others in there, but that's predominantly. So now we've seen the market go from direct mill plates back to direct mill is a better solution.
Right.
So in your experience, when was that date? When did we reach the point where both the mounting technology, the optic itself, and just the doctrine got to the point where, you know what, this is something we can legitimately put on a defensive carry gun, maybe not yet a, you know, concealed carry gun, but a defensive carry gun?
I still don't think we're 100% there, but I think we hit the 80% solution maybe about 2018, 2020. Somewhere in there, we kind of sort of figured out mounting. We kind of sort of figured out the mechanics. Right? And I say we, I'm talking the whole industry, right?
Of course.
I will give a tremendous amount of credit to Scott Jedlinski. Scott cracked the code for how to teach us to shoot the dot on a handgun. Other folks have taken that and kind of added their twist to it, their experiences to it. He kind of figured out that code and got it pushed out to everyone. Early on, we started doing Gunsight's Red Dot program. We started doing those classes in 2020, seeing about equal amounts of optics and mounting failures.
Okay.
Got to where, as it's continued on now into 2024, far fewer optics failures. Mounting failures were still there, but they're getting less as folks are pushing out kind of better mounting recipes.
Is that design and construction, or is that operator?
So I think it's operator. Okay. While I'm a fan of the Acro and the clamp across, right, that doesn't necessarily always work for a true concealed carry gun. Mm-hmm. So nothing wrong with bolting down into it. Just follow a good recipe. And one I found involves putting the whole thing together dry. Does it everything fit? Does it go together? Is there anything bent, warped, buggered up? No. Degrease everything. Come in, use Loctite, let it start the curing process. Assemble it to the torque values that the manufacturer says. Let it sit 24 hours. Not 30 minutes, not overnight, but let it sit a legit 24 hours for everything to cure. Then take it out and start your zeroing.
Okay.
And when you have to change, if you have to change, to remove it to change batteries or anything else, that process has to be repeated.
And I mean, let's talk about that for a second as well. I mean, the early dots, be it the first generation Delta Point or whatever, you know, you had to remove them to pull the battery.
Yes.
How was that ever designed to be a good idea? I mean,
I think that carried over from the put it on a rifle.
Okay.
I think that was there for putting it onto a rifle, right? And that was just what folks went with. Trigicon being the ones that had the most obvious battery underneath, right? Mm-hmm. We were over there talking to them. They've got the RCR, their enclosed emitter optic battery up top. They've got the RMR-HD, their new version of their RMR. Heavy duty, top-mounted battery. Their SRO went with a top-mounted battery. So it's kind of only the RMR, the stock RMR design, that still has to be pulled off the gun to swap it out. I mean, the Leupold, you mentioned the Delta Point Pro.
Yeah, the Pro, that was the change. They put it to the top mount,
Yeah. It just boggles my mind that it's 2024 and there are still people creating red dots that you have to remove them to change the battery. Like that, I mean, I get it. It's, there's certain designs and certain ways, but it's like, what is it? You know, what do you think it's going to take to get us to a point where that is just not going to be a thing anymore, and you're not going to have to remove them?
The market.
Yeah.
When company X that does that doesn't get anyone buying it,
okay,
and everyone's going over to company Y, where mm-hmm. it's a top-mounted battery, I would hope the engineers and the execs at company X go, maybe we shouldn't do that anymore.
Yeah. Okay.
So top-mounted battery does a couple of things. It adds more parts and complexity, which means it adds more cost. It also adds more failure points. It also makes you a little bit taller. I think it's a little bit of a price point play now that you could probably get into a less expensive optics that are bottom mount. You're paying extra for the convenience, but right. I mean, it seems like a no-brainer in my mind. It's worth it. As we see the move from just defensive dot guns to carry dot guns, mm-hmm. is that an equipment issue and change, or is that just more of a doctrine mindset change?
I think people are seeing the advantages of the dot and wanting to incorporate that into their concealed carry, their defensive lifestyle. It's not a panacea. I can't just throw a dot on a gun, hand it to somebody, and turn them into a master class shooter. Mm-hmm. If I could, I would be a master class shooter, right? So they're still going to have to put work into it. They're going to have to put the work in with dry practice on the front end, learning how to acquire the dot, then learning how to acquire it from concealment, then from a ready position, then from some other altered, buggered up things that maybe you only see in a match or in a good training class. Mm-hmm. As more folks put the time and effort in, they're going to have benefit. But, and I'm not slamming anybody when I say this, if your gun is the one that normally sits in the sock drawer and the only time you shot it was when you first bought it, I would recommend strongly against putting a dot on it.
Okay.
So then, okay, that brings me to a question. Dan, does your carry gun have a dot on it?
Mine does not. Well, not my carry gun. My nightstand gun, my 1911, does have one of the pop the dovetail out the back plates.
Okay.
And a Vortex red dot. And my shotgun, my turkey gun, is a red dot as well.
Okay. Well, and that's a whole other aspect that haven't talked about is hunting dots, too. Yeah. You know?
And my AR is a red dot, but a tube red dot with a magnifier, flip-up magnifier. So very much in the red dot. My wife's 9mm carbine is a green dot, and it's actually a SIG that has the triangle Predator.
Okay.
And then you can do the dot, and, you know, it's like a 2 MOA dot or a 12 MOA.
Sure.
Triangle,
right.
Because for her, not being super well versed in using the gun, I'm like, if you can just get that triangle
right.
on someone's chest, you're going to hit them.
Put the triangle on the vitals and squeeze the trigger.
Yeah, exactly.
as long as you're making a trigger press, that's really the key. So you'd referenced a second ago the benefits of a dot.
Right.
So can you run us through the benefits and the drawbacks of dots, or I shouldn't say drawbacks, but the potential negatives of a dot?
So biggest benefit I see is it simplifies the sighting solution, right?
One sight plane.
Right. I'm not trying to look through a rear sight at the front sight, focus on the front sight, put that in the center of what I'm trying to hit while still making sure mm-hmm. that it is a threat that requires lethal force, right? That makes it easy. I think you get better visual input coming to you in. The drawbacks are it's an electronic object, it's a mechanical object. In addition to that, and more importantly, is you still have to put some work in.
Of course.
Iron sights were good. We could get away with being sloppy because as the pistol was being presented, if we were off, left, right, up, down, our eyes would pick up that kind of peripherally and begin to correct for it, and we could still work it. With the dot, if you don't have a precise, consistent presentation, the dot's not going to end up where you want it. And the other problem is a tendency for people to treat the dot like a match sight. And what I mean is we've talked to people about shooting equal light, equal height on iron sights. If that carries over to the dot without kind of some understanding of what it will do for you, now you watch them going, it's slow, and they're trying to get the dot exactly in the center of the window, which is what's slowing them down. Mm-hmm. So there's got to be the work so they understand what they're dealing with and when they can be sloppy, and I don't necessarily mean that. I can't think of a better word.
Right.
You
the
can be less precise. Yes. When you can be less precise or when you need to be more precise.
The thing that you, this is not a pun, but that you opened my eyes to in the Gunsight Red Dot class about dots is, you know, I'm used to front sight focus,
right.
Rear sight fuzzy, target a little fuzzy.
Yep.
And then when I had the dot, I was trying to do the same thing, staying focused on the dot. You basically told me treat it like a laser and be target focused and just let the dot appear. Right. And all of a sudden, my presentation speed went up, my accuracy went up.
Yep.
And it changed for someone who'd been shooting dots for quite a while. It completely changed that.
Yeah, when I first started shooting the dot, I hated the damn thing. And I shot them on a few different guns, and I hated every single one of them because I was trying to shoot it like it was irons. Yeah. And then someone explained the exact same thing to me, and it's just, it's like a light bulb goes off, you know?
Go over and put blue painter's tape over the front of the optics. Someone very wise taught me that. And, man, you want to see a shooter freak out, and you first do that, and then they start shooting it and realize they can?
Yeah.
It's crazy. I mean,
and for the people it works for, that way of doing occluded optic work to get the visual shift from the sights onto the target works great. There are some folks who have eye issues, wiring issues that doesn't necessarily work for. Another thing you were talking about, looking at the dot, if folks are focusing on the dot rather than the target, that dot moves a whole lot more.
Yeah.
Right.
And because the dot is so much smaller than the iron sight, right? Most of our dots are 3 to 6 MOA. Your iron sights are like 11 to 16 MOA, but people don't necessarily think about that. That dot moves too. I'm sorry. The iron sights move too, right, as much as the dot does, but the iron sights don't look like it.
Well, and being a projected light source magnifies all that as well.
Exactly.
You know, we were talking with a revolver instructor earlier today, and this the idea of dot movement came up as well. And we all agree that as far as a dry fire training tool, red dots are fantastic. Because as he put it, nothing shows your inadequacies faster.
I think he said a personal earthquake.
Yeah. He thinks he's a great shot. He's like, I have got a great trigger press with iron sights. The minute he goes to the red dot, he's like, I'm having my own personal earthquake.
Yeah.
Just watching the dot dance tells you, hey, I'm coming left. Oh, I jerked that trigger. It's a great tool for shooting, but it's an even better tool for training.
Yeah.
You don't have to change your trigger press when you go to the dot. But the dot will change your trigger press. And I usually get people looking at me scratching their head when I say that. I'm like, pick up the gun, shoot it, right?
Right.
You don't have to change it. And then, but start paying attention to the feedback the dot's giving you.
Yeah.
Iron sights whisper, dots scream.
Yeah, that, I like that. I like that. And, you know, I will say probably the best thing you can do with the dot, gun sight, and Eric Gelhaus, Jedi, Scott Jedlinski. There's a number of outstanding instructors that are, that's what they do. And, as with anything, a good instructor can completely change your game.
But, oh, absolutely. But, and I think we know a few good instructors, so, and a few good places to go and do it, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Eric, thanks so much for coming and talking dots with us. I mean, it is a huge topic, and it's not going to get any smaller. The dots may get smaller,
I've seen a few coming down the road. They are going to be getting very smaller.
Yep. So once again, Eric, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thanks, guys. I'm very glad I could come by and spend some time with you.
Appreciate having you.
All right. Well, that's it for another episode of the No Low Ballers podcast. Appreciate each and every one of you who has tuned in either on the audio version or the video version. Make sure you're subscribed on your favorite platform. Leave us some likes and comments and reviews. We do read and respond to it all. We appreciate each and every one of you being here and consuming this show because hopefully you're having as much fun watching it as we have making it, because without you, there is no us, and we love being us. We have a great time on this show. So we will see you right here on the next episode of the No Low Ballers podcast.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.